10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from London, this is the Sunday Morning Breakfast Show with Sobhya Iqbal on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Sobhya's Stellar Sunday. It's Sunday, the 12th of May. We have the best conversations coming your way. We'll be exploring the history of ed tech, lessons learned pre and post COVID, and how to select the right solutions for your digital ambitions. We'll also be discussing how to set boundaries and form new habits. It's another thrilling morning. Prepare for takeoff.
Live from London, this is the Sunday Morning Breakfast Show with Sobhya Iqbal on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, welcome. Al has spent the last 30 years in EdTech, 10 years with his board of CN Governor. He is a group CEO of NetSupport Limited, an internationally acclaimed vendor. He has also lived and worked in both the US and UK. He is chair of a mainstream multi-academy trust and chair of an alternative provision academy. Alongside these roles, Al sits on the Regional Schools Commissioner Head Teachers Board for the East of England and North East London. He's also an independent chair of the country's SENB Board. He's an author, a member of the Forbes Technology Council, and the Advisory Council for the Foundation of Education Development. We're going to come back to Al in just a moment. Morning, everyone who's entered the studio. I can see loads of people in today. Morning, Annabelle. We'll be coming back to Annabelle later on in the show. Okay, Al, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Good morning, everybody.
Morning. Al, firstly, I want to start off just by saying happy birthday. I know that it was your birthday week.
Oh, bless you. Thank you very much.
And also, I was doing some research on you and I found out that you like classic cars. Is that correct?
It is a little bit of a vice of mine. I have been a lover and a fan of classic cars for many years, yes.
Okay, so it was hilarious because on Twitter, I actually posted a tweet with lots of classic cars and Al was quick to say, those are not my cars, but he wished he had them. So Al, what kind of classic cars do you like?
Oh, I'm a bit of a, I think the right term is a cornucopia. I like all kinds of old cars. I think there's a design measure really in terms of some of the shapes and styling of older cars that I think we've never managed to match or better with newer designs. So over the years, I've restored a classic 1972 Mini for my son as his first car. And then when it was finished being restored, I decided it really wasn't the safest vehicle for a first car. So that project was more the making it than the enjoying and driving it. And I'm very fortunate that I've got an old classic Porsche 911 that I've spent many years having restored. And that's my go-to well-being space.
And that's brilliant because I actually was reading up about the Porsche 911, the one with the 2.0 engine. And it was saying that it's nearly 50% more power than other Porsches for its time. So it was the fastest car for its time, wasn't it?
The original ones absolutely were, yes. I'm quite lucky. Mine's are back from the 90s. So it's that kind of middle zone of classic Porsches. But it was the very first ever four-wheel drive Porsche. But I think like a lot of people, you kind of get drawn to vehicles that were originally the posters on your bedroom wall when you were a child.
Yes.
And I love the shapes and the curves of those. So I think we all need to have some vice. And that's a pretty safe one, I reckon, in the bigger scheme of things.
Well, it sounds like a cool vice. You also like dogs. And what breed do you have?
Oh, you shouldn't get me started on the pooches. I'm very lucky. I've got two older Labradoodles who are 14 and 12, Waffle and Basil, who very much sleep their days away now with interludes of eating in between, and a very active and feisty Cockapoo who's just turned two, who goes pretty much everywhere with me and certainly is seen on a daily basis around the offices or if I'm out and about.
Oh, that sounds great. And I bet when you get free time, they're the only ones that you want to spend time with.
Obviously, my wife would strongly disagree with me on that statement. But I think in the true spirit of a successful marriage being about compromise, it's worth acknowledging she's not the biggest pooch fan. So I'm very blessed that she's very tolerant about my my passion for the hounds.
Oh, that's great. Al, for our listeners, can you please describe your background in education and some of the projects you've been involved in the past and you're currently involved in now?
I will do my best, yes. Those who do know me will know I often refer to myself as a man of two halves. So I spent the last 30 years in education, in one sense from the commercial world, as an edtech vendor, developing and designing technology and solutions for use in schools all around the world. And a parallel to that, I mentioned family, and I have two children who've been through the education system and out the other side. And when they were very young, I was very keen to be involved in helping support the growth of our schools. So I became a governor of a school in Peterborough when it was first opened, brand new school, and moved from being a governor to the chair of the governing body there. And then we became a multi-academy trust. Initially, ironically, a multi-academy trust of one, but that allowed us to bid for free schools, and we've opened a new secondary school. Then one of our secondaries became an all-through provision, and then we've opened primaries and built on that basis. Working with a local authority, became chair of the Governor Leadership Group, and through that work joined other schools where they had an IEB or needed support to help grow and develop their governance and leadership. So have been involved in infant schools as well. And linking from that, I've been a member of the Regional Schools Commissioner's Head Teacher Board. And again, there being the person to provide some insight and challenge in terms of governance and financial management and probity of schools. And then linked to that, which all these things are interwoven, where there have been multi-academy trusts that have got different challenges. I've been asked by the RSE to go and join that governing body to help shape change or improvement within those schools. I'm also a real focus and fan in terms of that equality for all. So I do sit and chair the regional SEND board because I think that's a really key part of the service and building blocks that we provide. And I'm chair of an academy, which is an alternative provision just for those learners that struggle with mainstream education. And again, I think that combination of all means that hopefully I get a really broad insight across all strands of the education spectrum.
That's fantastic. What I like about you, I was reading your book and you said that you believe in the big C's: context, community, collaboration, communication, content, co-construction and creativity. And then you also said that you like students, you like to celebrate compassionate, capable and confident educators. And I found that fascinating because it resonated with me knowing that you are a colleague, a professional colleague who does look at the bigger picture, and you are focused in a lot of areas, not just ed tech. So yeah, I was very impressed with that, Al.
Thank you. That's lovely to hear. I think I should probably say it quietly because if I might get in trouble. But I am very much a believer when it comes to school leadership that the bigger picture about what we provide for our learners is much broader than the finite assessments that our children leave their school with and their qualifications. And personally, I think that breadth of experience, the way that we celebrate, give young people opportunities, that memories that we take away from school, for me, count more than one grade point on their progress 8 or attainment 8. Now, obviously, in an ideal world, we want to deliver everything and both, and we want our learners to have the best qualifications that open up their next pathways. But I always kind of reference things like, I'm a firm believer there's more than one pathway when we leave school for education. I'm an apprenticeship ambassador for the East of England, for example. And whilst I think it's fantastic as many of our learners go on to university, I always find it quite frustrating that that's deemed the only real measure of success post-16 in our schools that we're actually recorded against. And actually, there are so many pathways and success stories that as a lifelong learner, I really think we need to embrace the wider measure, not just those small few stepping stones of exam success.
Yes, I agree with that. So how did you get into ed tech then?
Well, I guess having kind of covered my background and my two halves, one of the things I think that I'm in a very blessed and fortunate position to be in is that I spend lots of time within schools trying to support, improvement, change, and sometimes that support, frankly, is just an ear and a shoulder, because often change isn't needed, doing fantastic things. But given my role and 30 years running an ed tech company, one of the things that is that lovely fusion is not just seeing challenges, but actually coming up with solutions. And sometimes the solution does involve, let's go away and make something. But as we've seen over many a decade, you know, the worst measure of making a product or a solution is just to go away and figure out what you think people need. It's much better to actually work with the people that need it and actually deliver something that they actually want. That saves the subsequent iterations before you get it right. So the EdTech really is a way of me taking my passion for technology and coming up with solutions to problems with my kind of core passion, which is about education being that level of unlocking the opportunity and potential for everybody.
And in terms of your background, just so that our listeners are clear, did you do a technology degree? What's your background?
Again, I should probably say it quietly because people might go, oh, no, not that. But my original background when I started off on my journey was in finance. I worked for Barclays Bank and then Unilever Management Accounting. So I learned finance first and then sort of segued and decided that actually it was the advent when IT systems were moving from being a mainframe in a building somewhere to being more desktop and portable, that the technology, the way that we actually move and share data and access information was far more interesting to me than balance sheets. Now, both skills have been quite useful as life's gone on. But that was the point where I was one of the very few that was looking at the IT team and saying, I think that's more interesting. And at the time, my managers and senior colleagues were looking at me like I was a really crazy fool. But if you work in somewhere, you know, fantastic organizations as they are, Barclays or Unilever, as one small speck, your ideas for innovation are very limited. You really are working to a very well-versed and many, decades of established process and protocol. And I've always been somebody, certainly when I was younger, that got frustrated quickly when you had good ideas, but nowhere to take them and nothing that you could do with them. So taking that step into the technology where actually every year the technology moves on, so there's no such thing as a fixed way of doing things, kind of aligned much more to my aspirations.
That's very similar to how I started out. I started off in finance as well and then moved over to education and IT. One of the things that, I found from your book, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, you know, finance was behind and there wasn't much innovation. And sometimes I feel it's a bit like that in education as well. But there's a quote that you've said in your book, and I'm just going to read it out because there's two quotes that resonated with me really well. Do you run or exercise? Yes. Do you run or exercise better listening to music? Yes. Well, think of teaching as running and you'll do it much better thinking of technology as the music. Now, I like that because having been in education for the last 16 years, and we're going to come on to this in a bit, it's not all, you know, it's not always easy to work in ed tech because obviously that's not the first, obviously technology, there's other priorities in schools which take priority over ed tech. And sometimes it can be frustrating for those of us who are involved in IT and tech. Another one said that technology will never replace great teachers, but technology is in the hands of a great teacher that can be transformational. Now, based on your journey in ed tech, what mishaps have you had that are both humorous and serious? And what lessons have you actually learned throughout your ed tech journey?
Goodness, there's quite a long list there. I mean, the first thing I will absolutely resonate for me is that technology is there as a facilitator. All these pathways, whatever we're talking about the successful adoption of technology, ultimately come down to the human factor. And more often than not, time, giving people the time to build confidence in the use of something or the time to actually make sure that all the voices have been heard before you head off on a journey. So tech is but one part of the jigsaw puzzle. The irony, of course, sometimes is that we talk about not having enough time to look and implement edtech when actually one of the byproducts and outcomes of successful tech adoption can be creating time, freeing up time. So we do have a little bit of a chicken and egg sometimes in how we tackle those things. You know, in terms of my career, and experiences. I think the first thing is, which is something that I see as a strength, not a weakness, is confession number one. I've made loads of mistakes, but I actually think we're both personally and as a business, we're stronger for it. So I often use the phrase that, mistakes are stepping stones to success, because I think you actually learn more from your mistakes than you do from your successes in a counterintuitive way. What I have learned is, and it feeds absolutely into what we've seen over the last 18 months, are two strands. One is, within reason, it's okay to take risks. You actually have to step outside your comfort zone and try new things to figure out whether they do or don't work, but not be afraid if they don't work. You've still learned something by that process in time. The bigger one, which from an EdTech advocate might seem, again, a little bit counterintuitive, is that less is more. Actually trying to do a few things well has far more benefit than trying to do a lot of things. Technology, whilst, it's here to stay, and we also want our learners to walk into the workplace familiar and not fearful of technology, it isn't a race to who can have the most. And so I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned is to sometimes just slow it down a bit, Al. Don't try and do too much too quickly, because if you get a few core building blocks well, if you're able to evidence they've had a positive impact, that builds confidence and allows you to build the additional layers down the line, make decisions with stronger confidence than trying to do everything all at once. And so some of the lessons we might talk about, moving forward, about looking at that bigger picture of, well, where does digital fit in the future in our schools? It's about looking at the things that have worked well and how do we embed them? How do we make staff confident and comfortable using them, our learners confident with them, and not try and, take it to level 10 automatically or overnight?
And some of the things that you discuss, which again I found quite interesting and also is accurate based on my experience as well, you discuss this section about the history of ed tech, and it's about interactive whiteboards, for example. And you mentioned the fact that the whiteboard is just used as a surface to, just to write and annotate on. And I feel like it has become like that. When we first started, it was very much different because it was brand new. But to me, in some of the schools that I've worked in, it very much is just like a projector now. And so it does question, you do think about this thing about schools that aren't effectively managing tech resources. And it is a poor use of public money, isn't it?
Well, yes, potentially. But like all these things, every school is different. I mean, I use perhaps the example, and I've seen it within our own school. So this, all the experiences and tips that I share in the book, are very much based on either personal experience or experience of colleagues that I trust and how they've evolved within their schools. There are plenty of schools that when you're building a brand new school, you've got the bricks and mortar and the cabling in. You're looking based on your funding for how do I equip this classroom. And one of the first things on the list is the interactive whiteboard. And often the question why is responded to, well, all our classrooms have got whiteboards, so of course we need them. And the question really should be, is that still the most appropriate technology in the classroom? I mean, why wouldn't, a screen sharing technology for your iPad or a visualizer linked to an LCD screen not be more effective? And the reality check, of course, is whiteboard may well be very effective, and I've seen it really well used effectively, particularly in primary phase. But it all comes down to a number of factors, which is when we put that technology in the classroom, did we just budget for the cost of the whiteboard, or did we actually budget for some continuous professional development for the staff who are using it to make sure that rather than the 10%, that surface that I can use different pens on to draw and annotate, did we go a level below to understand about the additional apps and resources that are built into it, or how I could leverage and connect other devices to it to get a greater return? And that's not different in our personal lives. We all have devices that we use, and we probably use X percent, of the available functionality and feature set. So I think what's happened is it's very easy as we become comfortable with technology to almost take it for granted. And by doing so, we never actually utilize it to its full capabilities, which is why when I look and say about looking at, our digital roadmap moving forward, I always say the first conversation needs to be to look backwards. Shouldn't we be getting the most out of what we've got before we just go and buy some more? isn't that common sense? But it's very easy in the heat of everything else to perhaps be more focused on what are we going to add without really challenging and reflecting on how effectively we're doing the current things with the current solutions we have available.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great. You write a section in your book that says don't always believe the hype about a new solution and just make sure you look for the evidence, which is exactly what you've just said. And some of the things that you go into your book is the fact that we all know there's lack of consistent funding, which holds back the use of tech in schools. And also some schools and organisations don't actually plan whether they can sustain what they've introduced as well. And so my question for you is, if you are a new leader in ed tech, or you're hoping to go into that area, what things should we be thinking about to implement a successful digital strategy so we are getting the best value for money and also thinking about getting a return on investment?
That's, you know, it's a really good question. And I suppose, not wishing to avoid the direct answer because I'll fill in some of the gaps, is what I try to do is provide the questions and things to consider rather than the answers. Because the answers are very much dependent on your school, your setup, your particular needs, and the experiences and strengths of your teaching cohort as well. So it won't be the same answer for every school. The first thing is that element of why. What are we trying to achieve? And so that involves bringing together all the key stakeholders so that you've got a voice about what the current challenges, pinch points are, and also what the aspirations might be. So I use a Venn diagram and very much say, you know, at the heart, the center, is the teacher and students. The feedback in terms of technology that works well, how it can, different ways of engaging with learners, which ones are more effective, what would be more useful in terms of, you know, whether it's speeding up the feedback loop or capturing assessments easily within the classroom, or just broader engagement. And then around that, we're plugging in, you know, the senior leadership team. So how does that align with our school development plan or our SEF, you know, in terms of what are our areas of development we want to focus on this year, next year, and so on. And then we're thinking about everything from our SCN team to our DSL and safeguarding considerations with any technology we incorporate. Our IT team, are we building on strong foundations, or would that involve us needing to update our network or our Wi-Fi infrastructure to leverage new devices if that's the pathway we think is best suited? And finance, you know, ironically, coming back to a point earlier on, for me sits at the side, not in the center. Too often, finance dictates what we're going to do this year. Where actually what we should be saying is, what are our aspirations? And then the finance will dictate the speed of the journey. It might take us 3 or 4 years to get where we're going. But what it does avoid, if you have that bigger picture of where you want to end up, is it avoids you making choices and purchases this year that actually won't build and allow you to get to that endpoint. In other words, they become short-term benefits, but then you actually discard them because the longer term you need to use a different tool that perhaps isn't compatible or isn't going to be suitable in your aspirations. So there are quite a few strands that I try and kind of break down the book in terms of making sure you bring those voices together. And if we think about my comment about the human factor, let's be realistic. You know, most projects, and we can think of whatever we do as a change within the school as a project, they're much more successful if everybody feels that they've had an ear, they're part of it, they know what's happening, they're coming along for the journey rather than being dragged along on the journey. And one of the worst things I see, particularly in larger mats or in school districts in the US, is when there's a central senior leadership decision on a technology and approach to do that is pretty much foisted on the staff at the start of the academic year. And then we wonder why that solution takes time to embed or doesn't have the impact that we'd originally hoped for. And that's often because actually the voices on the shop floor, in this case, in the classroom, are often the ones that are more aware of the pros and cons of tech, what it's meant for them to date. There may well be staff that have come from other schools who've got experience of where technology was positive and had an impact in their learning environment. So if we leave the decision-making purely strategically to the senior leadership team, you know, it's perhaps not always the case that they will have their own personal journey with tech to really reinforce the quality of the decisions taken. So this is one where I would argue strength of leadership is actually having the confidence and strength to delegate down and let the people working with our children actually be a key shaper of where our digital strategy goes.
Yeah, I mean, as a classroom teacher, I would agree with that. You know, you're having to, they're going to be the ones delivering the outcomes, so to speak, what you're trying to do. Leanne's messaged in and she says, I've had to think more carefully about what I buy for my classroom too. And that's because a lot of the digital, I think that's the digital stuff that she's talking about that she buys for her classroom resources. She has to pay out of her own money because obviously budgets are tight. So I assume that she means that budgets are tight and she's having to buy little things related to ed tech to help her deliver her lessons.
And that's a really important point though, Serbia, because there's the solutions that interconnect across a school, the data, the student performance information, communication systems and so on. And then there are other digital resources that are very much curriculum linked, which are within the budget of a department or a class. And where we want to, part of the idea of getting all these voices around the table is that we don't make decisions in silos. Now, choosing a solution that might be really great for your cohort, it might be that there's peers at similar levels or similar classes in schools across your map, for example, that might have already done the evaluation and research. So making sure that we've got that kind of open channel and communication about what's worked well and what hasn't is really important. And that comes back to my point about empowering people to take risks. You know, sometimes you don't want to take a risk because you don't want to spend time and money trying something to prove that actually it wasn't successful. And people don't like to have to put the hand up and say, actually, that didn't work. Whereas what we should be saying is, well, thanks for trying. At least now we've got more of a focus on what we don't want. And that's often just as an important shopping list as what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you've said. One of the things that I found in my journey is that sometimes some senior leaders don't understand technology. And it's quite common, obviously, in education because a lot of them come from other subject domains. They've not, you know, it's their first time in their leadership journey, maybe. And so there's this lack of inexperience. I mean, how would you, what kind of advice would you give to a senior leader who is in charge of dealing with this and getting the staff's buy-in?
I think there's a number of strands. I mean, one thing we've definitely seen over the last 18 months as part of an acceleration is a change in the way that we shop for EdTech. So rather than simply looking and saying, I found this solution, I think this is right for the school and hopefully the staff will be on board, how do we actually evidence the value of that technology? Well, now there's much more of a strength towards having research-informed evidence behind the solutions before we install and evaluate them. So obviously we can talk to peers in other schools for what solutions do you use of a similar ilk and which ones have been successful. But we can also go, and it's a vendor expectation now, where are the case studies? If it's pedagogy aligned, where's the evidence, the independent research that your solution works and will have a positive impact? So we can build confidence by having a really clear structure about how we evaluate and select EdTech. But then the second part, and I absolutely agree with your point, is that we need to, as senior leaders, we need to have confidence to actually empower those who are going to be ultimately using the solution to be involved in that decision-making process. Now, that might be the the comparative benchmark of one class is going to be using this new technology on evaluation for a month, and we're going to compare their progress or outcomes of a particular measure versus another class that isn't. It might be that they might be on the selection panel. There are lots of different ways that we can do that, but what absolutely isn't effective is just to top-down push it, surprise, this is what you're going to be using. And I think that comes from confidence of leadership. But let's be honest, if we're going to make a decision, don't we all feel a bit secure in making a decision if everybody's on board with it? It's now our collective decision. We stand or fail by that decision. It's much better than one person or one small group making a decision on something. But, we have also got within the last 18 months this huge resource now. It's grown, much like today's resource, but in the broader digital CPD. If you want to find out about a product, it's pretty easy to go and get other people's feedback now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, some of the things that you've said that should be on a checklist to find out those products are firstly, identify the opportunity. What is it that it's needed for? Evidence or estimate the demand, consider the environment. You've talked about when you're looking for products to actually look at reviews, think about the potential longevity of your solution, the costs. This is part of a vendor checklist, but it's also the same for schools, is it not, to think about these things?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the idea of a vendor checklist is a two-way street. You know, one of the reasons why I chose to put a section in the book about vendors was I think it's really important as the landscape's changed, particularly we've moved from buy a service, install it locally, and we're done, to cloud-based solutions where actually we're engaging in a contract, a subscription, which is going to renew, you know, year on year. If you're buying into a relationship, it's important that you understand what the constraints and aspirations of the vendor are, but also that checklist of understanding, well, if I go into this solution and I rely on it for all of my, you know, curriculum data, as well as my student data, as well as my safeguarding data, and it proves to be not the best solution, how locked into it am I? How easy is it for me to move my data and choose another solution? And this is part of that bigger digital strategy. It's not just what's available now, it's what might we want to do in 5 years from now. So a good example right now is schools will be looking at different assessment tools that they'll have on their project plan that 18 months, 2 years from now, we want to start building interactive charts and resources of data across our mat using Power BI or something. So we now know when we're looking at the solution today that it needs to have accessibility to that data, even though we're not going to use it straight away, so that we can plan about how we can start to join and connect the dots.
And so how should schools then be, I mean, you've already said reviewing it and checking with other people, but let's suppose an ed tech vendor approached the school directly or the school approached the vendor directly. How would a school, how would a school deal with them and, you know, think about whether that solution is suitable for their school?
So a really quick one, if we're in a direct, which let's be honest, is many of the relationships. So obviously the first question would be, is the product available for trial? Because we're not going to invest time and effort buying something until we know it works. How long's the trial for? Is there flexibility on that trial? Now, before we spend time doing it, can you give us the checklist of all the functionality of the product? Can you give us some reference sites where we can validate that? Have you got any independent reviews or research that's linked to your solution and the impact of the claims that you make about it? Then it would be about the vendor. How's it secure? Where is it? Do you have the right information? So as a school, we can fill in a DPIA, a data protection impact assessment. And now any school, any new tech, I'm sure you'll be familiar with having the network manager or somebody similar in the school wanting to know, what is the data that's going to be in this solution? Where's the data going to be stored? Who has access to it? How long is it there for? And we do that, whether it's our school CCTV system or it's our safeguarding system or it's our student data system. So in the book, I provide kind of checklists of things to be asking. And you really want to validate and tick all those boxes before you go to step two, which is, well, I'm now going to install the trial and have a play with it and make sure it meets my need. What you might also do at the same time as looking for that product is then see if there are alternatives so that you can do a compare and contrast. And then, of course, the final bit, and I'm skipping quite a few of the little sections, but the final bit is always about price. What are you locking into? Because, you know, technology is a fast-moving world. The solutions coming available now, many weren't available 2 years ago. So let's assume that 2 years from now, there'll be a lot of new great ones. You want to make sure that should you wish, down the line, you can jump to a new solution that might offer more for your money and better functionality. So understanding about how your solution interacts, its portability, and probably another lesson we've learned over the last 18 months about where possible, it being device agnostic, will it work across all the different platforms? So if I need to support, engage with my learners and they're on their home devices, will I get maximum connectivity? Or if as a trust or a school, we decide to acquire because they're good value Chromebooks next year rather than iPads, is this solution going to be transferable or am I going to have to go buy something different? Those kind of both thinking about the now but thinking about buying in the flexibility for the future, I think are really, really key.
And I mean, you talk about the future a lot in your book, and you do like mention this great article by Andreas Schleicher, who's in charge of the education skills and OECD. And he discusses about what education will look like in 20 years. And part of that is technology. And it's really interesting how there's some educators who don't believe that this is going to be the future. My question to you is, our students are using technologies that are available right now and ahead of what's in schools and workplaces. How are we going to develop students' digital skills to ensure we're keeping up to date with the latest trends in technology? Because schools are slightly behind.
Many schools are behind. I think there's a number to unpick there. The first thing is, for those that are unclear about whether technology has a role to play in the future, the reality check is there's no discussion. It's here already, and it's only going to amplify. We've seen it in the workplace. We've seen it in our personal lives. Why would education suddenly be different? Look up the tree. Look to our, when we move to our FE and HE, and the role that technology plays in terms of accessing information and lectures and learning that already exists. Those ecosystems have already moved forward. The reason why there's a concern is because the debate actually gets framed wrong. People really see the debate as, is there a difference between technology replacing the teacher? And that's a whole different conversation, because the simple answer to that is no. There's a big, big difference between what AI and technology can offer versus the human being. And back to the old Venn diagram, there is an overlap if we think about things like retrieval practice, personalized learning, but it's actually quite a small overlap where technology can supplement. It's not a replace, it's definitely a supplement. If we then think about schools and how do we keep on the technology path? Well, there's a big conversation about skills in the bigger workplace right now. And with skills, one of the things is about developing connections with the workforce and companies in your area, that employment base, to actually understand what the skills are that employers are looking for, because that often shapes what's most appropriate. That often isn't just at school level. That should be at local authority level and beyond. That helps focus on what are the platforms. So we've seen in many schools, you know, children perhaps, for example, spending their life on Chromebooks and working to a workplace which is all Microsoft and Office 365 and finding there's a disconnect. But actually a lot of the digital skills that now employers are looking for are much more about skills with tools for data manipulation and assessment, as well as obviously all of the social media and marketing tools that go there. So one is about absolutely schools looking and seeing what businesses are using and making sure that's part of their journey. Children have an opportunity to experience and get access to those technologies. There's the teaching the skills as a digital citizen to how to use effectively and safely technology. And that's probably the most important priority in terms of what we can focus on. And then there's the biggest of all, unfortunately, which is out of our power because it's at the government centrally, which is we can't keep building new schools and putting a pot of money to fit them out with technology if as soon as that technology laps, there's nothing left in the budget 4 or 5 years down the line to replace and renew. So the funding formula has got to at some point recognise that there are plenty, the majority of schools that need help, not just as a one-off when we're short a kit, as we've seen over the last 18 months, on an ongoing basis to make sure that our learners are equipped with the right technology. So that's capital funding, really, on a sustainable basis. And that's part of my interest and involvement with the Fed, is very much looking at this kind of roadmap of a 10-year vision for education, not one that's shaped by a success or failure within one political cycle, which is where we sit at the moment, but something long-term that means that digital, the technology and the skills we focus on during that journey can be interwoven over a longer period of time.
Yeah, that sounds great. Obviously, one of the things that is an issue in schools is what you've just said, that politically, every time the cycle changes, we've got different things coming in. And then obviously, you talk about building schools for the future, which used to be an initiative that was rolled out before this current government, and that was stopped. And then obviously, the free school system came in and the academy system came in. One of my next questions is, you know, when you're discussing developing teacher digital skills, how would you go about in trying to secure buy-in from staff who are still very much in the mindset of teaching and learning comes first, and I don't really need to learn technology?
It's a real difficult one. You know, I actually think, particularly after the last couple of years, that's probably a smaller minority. Again, this isn't a one or t'other. You know, the priority is always teaching and learning about the experience and recognizing where technology can help, support and facilitate as part of that human-to-human interaction. What I always say in schools is this usual thing about connectivity and communication. So we've seen, for example, whether you're a Google or a Microsoft school, been using Teams more effectively over the last 18 months, for example, that actually there's a whole strand of support for communication between staff that can be a really positive and important one. The skills we've learned about creating when we do our synchronous lessons, actually thinking that asynchronously we can record exemplars. Well, they become just the same mechanism for recording the way that we use tools as exemplars for other staff to share and engage. One of the things I always say is, who are your flag bearers? Who are the go-to people in your school that have confidence in different tools that are part of your overall school systems? Actually recognizing who the go-to people are gives people a lot more confidence to go away and try. I'm absolutely not a believer in the, we've got a day and a half of inset at the start of the year, let's give everybody a four-hour overload of EdTech and off you go. It needs to be, schools need to be thinking about how we can develop that continuous professional development, bite-sized chunks, and actually offset that with how we're going to free up the time to allow staff to do that. But that sense of, like any technology, if you use it regularly, you build confidence. If you know who the go-to person is, you're much more inclined to try things because you've got someone to go and bounce ideas off. If you've got big, those kind of exemplars, then again, the same applies. You can access it anytime that suits you.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. In my school, I've currently rolled it out. So I've got, for example, I have one-to-one coaching sessions, which is a drop-in surgery. I've also got departmental training that I'm doing, going around to departments. And then I'm also doing whole school training as well. And I think that's kind of the route that you need to go to. You need to have someone that, you know, because obviously there's this fear factor, you know, when you're using technology. Staff have this fear factor that something's going to go wrong, just like children do, because I taught IT for many years and children just wouldn't like making a mistake, or they were scared they were going to break something. And, you know, one of the best ways of learning is to make mistakes. That's how I learned IT and computer science. And I think that's the kind of mindset we need to get staff and students into, that it's okay to make mistakes.
Absolutely. And to reassure, when I walk into a classroom, and I don't do it on a daily basis, but quite regularly I'm in the classroom, particularly at STEM events, talking about the use of VR and AR and other solutions, I have that fear factor, because no matter how confident you are in the technology, when you walk in a room, you never quite know if that machine in front of the class will behave the way you will, whether the students' devices will fire up and be on point quickly and as effectively as you want. The thing with technology is always about, if you use something regularly, you have much more confidence. You know, I've heard the example of, if you know Ofsted are coming for a visit today and they're going to be looking at your lessons, is your inclination to reach them and roll out the iPad trolley, or are you going to do something on the front of class with the students? And that's often a good internal litmus test as to how confident you feel with the EdTech. And it's natural that the majority of people will always have concerns, because let's be honest, technology isn't infallible. There are times where it just doesn't do quite what you'd hoped.
Yeah, I mean, technology failed on me last week when I was doing this show, for example. It does fail on you. And, you know, the thing with being an IT or computing teacher was, we were always trained to have a backup just in case it does fail.
Yeah.
And I think it's very fast-paced in schools now. So technology is a lot more reliable than it used to be. However, there are some issues. I mean, my co-host Graham is going to come on after my show, and he's going to be discussing why technology is so crap in schools. But it has improved from what we used to have.
Massively, yes.
Yeah, especially since remote learning. I mean, obviously, we were forced into the pandemic, and we were forced into a new way of working. Some teachers and schools have gone back to normal teaching without technology after remote learning. How can we, as schools, maintain momentum to ensure EdTech remains beneficial to enhance teaching and learning?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important questions that we all need to reflect on. I mean, I'm not so worried about the, we've gone back to the way we used to do things with our learners, because actually our priority when learners came back into school was much more focused around their social emotional health. And I was really pleased to see, you know, the things they'd miss most, the opportunities to do more sports activities, drama, music, those things collaboratively were back on the agenda. What we've learned, though, is we've seen that EdTech can have a positive role in different ways, whether it's the simple example that I often use and many others do about how it can be much better for parents and staff, or parents even, using technology in a blended way so that we not only can access some of our harder to reach families who wouldn't normally turn up for parents evenings, but also manage staff wellbeing by having it really tightly scheduled and that can be done from home or from school, but it finishes on time and it's really well structured. Or the way that we've got better communication between our departments and we can use that both professionally and personally in terms of support and communication. And then, of course, I don't like the C, the catch-up word. I like a lot of C's, but not that one, because I think it's a very negative term. But if we're looking about how we're going to be moving forward, then we've got to recognise that alongside the fantastic pedagogy that happens in the classroom, there are tools that can help children build on their knowledge and stretch in their own time with that kind of personalised learning, the AI-based solutions that are becoming more prevalent. And so this is about, we've always said we couldn't talk about EdTech that much because we just haven't had time. We've proven with everything else on the go for schools to take on board additionally that we managed to talk about EdTech and we managed to implement things way quicker than most verticals and marketplaces could. So schools did an amazing job. And now we've got in the position where we can get back to what we do best. We should be embracing the fact that some of this will actually speed up, save time, make us more efficient to do that stuff we do best. It's not a replacement of. And I think the final bit that I always try and sow the seed of is if you go looking for technology to fit the way you do something now, then it may well, you'll find the right tool and it will work for you. But wouldn't it be better to be looking to see what technology is out there that you could leverage? It might involve you changing the way that you do things now. But as a result of that, the speed of innovation within your school is likely to be far faster.
Yeah, I mean, one of the good things that did come out of remote learning was the online parents' evenings, which staff and students and parents are loving because, you know, before it would take hours to go through parents' evening, but now it's just very, very simple. And everybody seems to be happy with that. So we can take good things from the pandemic and the situation we were in and continue that.
Absolutely. And I'm certainly hoping in the Easter holidays, rather than all of our staff coming in for GCSE revision classes, we'll learn the lessons and think we can do them online to the 50% of students that normally turn up and attend. But we'll also then have recorded lessons that the other 50% might access at a time that suits them. Again, we've saved staff travel time. We've potentially made that content accessible to a broader audience. And we're just building on the skills that we've acquired over the last 18 months.
And for schools that have PFI contractors out, and I know you're going
to,
I had to go there because obviously having experienced it several times now. What are your thoughts on PFI contractors?
Well, I'll start with the take a few letters off that word. I'm not a huge fan of PFI contracts in the broader sense. They were a means to an end to get the private sector in to deliver new schools and projects in the broader sense. But, you know, they often came at a significant long-term financial cost. The biggest challenge, I think, for schools that were built under PFI contracts and have many of their services wrapped around that is it's the disconnect because the school actually isn't the key stakeholder in the contract. It's the local authority that set up the, as often referred to, SPV, Special Purpose Vehicle, the entity that runs the contract. And so it often feels a little bit like it's something that you've got to deal with, but you've got limited control over. In schools that I know that are have been built and delivered under PFI, the challenge with PFI contractors is really comes down to how you best manage the conditions that you've got under that special purpose vehicle. And when I say the conditions, I mean the service level agreement in terms of what they deliver, the timeliness of it. Some schools have been successful with the support of local authorities in renegotiating the terms of PFI contracts to somewhat reduce down that big hit every year that they're contributing towards. But others have used it as a mechanism to effectively track the speed and timeliness of the services they've got bought in, whether it's cleaning, IT, ground services, whatever it might be. Often it's, you know, playing field management and maintenance or, you know, AstroTurf and all those kind of bits and pieces. And often it's quite a lot of work to actually manage and hold to account the expectations of service versus what you get. But there are mechanisms, but it does involve the local authority to support you on it.
I'm asking because I've worked for a couple of organisations that are part of a PFI contract, mm-hmm. and sometimes the service you get is not fantastic. So what should schools be thinking about when managing that service and also their IT infrastructure as well?
Well, certainly my starter for 10 would be to actually get the detailed copy of what was built under the project agreement in terms of level of service, timeliness, and what it fully encompassed. And then would be to track what you get against that so that you've actually got that direct comparison to then go back and challenge under the project agreement the delivery if you're not happy of it. If you're not happy with it and you can evidence that it's not being met against the service, then you've got two pathways. You've got one to negotiate the amount you're paying, or secondly, an attempt to remedy it. You are somewhat locked in within that process. If your IT is under that PFI as well, and for many, the IT was at the initial delivery, there was like a separate wave that came under BSF with the projects where IT could be built as part of that project, then the same applies, which is what's the expectation? Do a compare and contrast, get an external to come in, an external company. There are plenty of school-specific IT providers that will come in and do a school IT audit for you, identify what you've got, where your pinch points are, and what you might need to adapt or adjust in the future. That typically ends up being the stuff you can't see in the cupboards, like the patch panels and switches that need to be upgraded and so on, but also about unlocking your ability as part of your digital strategy. If your direction of travel is to the cloud, for example, or a particular platform as your base across the school or map, and then you can use that to hold that against your provider under the PFI and say, this is what we're expecting to do. How are you going to meet that, and what are the timelines you're going to define from it? More often than not, whilst there's always a bluff and blustering, there is an opportunity to then revisit and renegotiate under that project agreement.
Yeah, thank you for all that information. That's very useful. For those schools who are out there using PFI contracts to get their services, service delivery, please do look at your contracts carefully to find out what's involved in them. And then obviously you can do something about it if you are receiving a poor service or a service that's not expected. And like I said, Graham is going to come up next after my show, and he is going to be talking about technology failure. So that's worth tuning into next at 11 o'clock this morning as well. Al, you've seen lots of changes in ed tech over the course of your career. What kind of things are you excited about right now? What things were definitely right to go? And are we moving in the right direction for the future?
Well, I am excited. I think probably if I pick the single most thing I'm excited about, is that for the first time in probably 20 years, it actually has visibility. We're actually looking and talking about EdTech. And by the nature of talking about it, it opens up us the opportunity to be receptive to trying new things. And actually that change of mindset is pretty massive, because we've been working for decades on the basis of, if we did this, it might help, it could help. Now we're talking about, over the last 18 months, we've seen this solution has helped. It did do this. We've already put it in place. So now how can we build on it? So I think that change of mindset is really, really important. And actually, centrally, if we think from an England perspective, I think for the first time, we've got a slight change from the schools minister, where EdTech has been a bit of a dirty word, to being slightly more receptive to the role and the approach that it can take, particularly in terms of leveling the playing field. So that for me is something that we should be really excited about, although we've still got the barrier about appropriate levels of funding to ensure that we can actually meet some of those aspirations. I think the things that we're doing right at the moment are really about looking at the tools we've implemented and how we can build on them. Where I'm nervous is about schools and leaderships that try and slip back into the comfort zone of, well, the pandemic's kind of over, so let's go back to the way we did things.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was impressed with, and this does come back down to the digital divide that we've had for many, many years, and the lack of broadband access for everybody to level the playing field, is the fact that, you know, the government is trying its best. They did bring out the EdTech Demonstrator Program, which was fantastic for schools that don't have the budgets. Having a school that's actually implemented systems and is, you know, having a wonderful time with EdTech and their strategy is fantastic. Linking with a school that isn't up to that standard is such a good initiative.
I'm a big fan, and I think it's been a great way of showcasing best practice because that builds confidence itself. It doesn't mitigate the fundamental challenge, which is whilst we can access EdTech demonstrator schools for free and get best practice and advice and see how they're doing things, it still doesn't always remove, unfortunately, the block, which is I'd love to do that, but I can't afford to. How am I going to do it? So it certainly helps shape our aspirations that we're actually, again, those kind of pedagogy and research informed best practice, somebody else who's been there, done that, and they've actually got the evidence to show the impact. That helps build confidence, which most of these strands, frankly, come back to building confidence. So it means as we shape a digital strategy, we're actually building on some sound foundations of knowledge. And of course, that's really important. What we need to do is align the EdTech narrative around the innovator schools and the evidence with making sure that there is the suitable funding to make sure that all schools have the opportunity to level up their technology at the same level. And when I say level up technology, it's two parts. There's the physical hardware and software, and there's the CPD for the staff to actually get the most out of it. And the two have to go hand in hand.
Brilliant. Al, what's next for you in your journey?
Probably breakfast, but that's quite a short-term view. Longer term, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position. I love what I do. I get the opportunity to travel all around the world, learn from lots of amazing people, and get to share it. I've been, you know, very fortunate to write my secret EdTech diary, and it is still a secret, but I will be doing, and am in the process of doing one on governance, because governance is another area where I think there's a really good synergy of bringing skills from other sectors into education in a symbiotic way. We you can bring skills, but you can also learn lots about the way that schools do things, that reflective practice that you can take back into business and benefit from. So there'll be another book on the horizon at some point in the coming months. Beyond that, I think we've all got plenty to focus on in the short term. You know, my biggest one is we've developed a new solution, Classroom Cloud, which is very much built on the lessons of the last 18 months. And I'm never happy till it's as near perfect as it can be. So we're very much focused on building and developing that solution.
That sounds great. And Noreen's just said yay to governance, because obviously she has an interest in that as well. Where can people find for more information if they wanted to know more?
Absolutely. They can find me in lots of places. If you head across to Twitter, AlKingsley_edu's a great place. If you want to find out a bit more about me and the book and other resources, alkingsley.com. And you'll always find me at netsportsoftware.com, where we've got our portfolio of solutions.
Brilliant. It's always brilliant talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in. And please
Likewise.
Do keep in touch with TTR Radio.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Right. Okay. We're going to head over to our sponsors and then the news. And then we're going to come back with Annabelle. Please stay tuned. It's going to be fab.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique, challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors, and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles, and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website, www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
A report by BBC Newsround highlights the fact that 2 UK teachers are shortlisted the final 50 for the World's Best Teacher Award. Both teachers work in schools in England. Kat Davison is a critical thinking teacher at Sevenoaks School in Kent, and David Swanston is a teacher of the visually impaired at St Vincent's School in Liverpool. The competition has attracted more than 8,000 applications from 121 countries. Ms Davison has been praised by the school's head teacher for her work inspiring young people to play an active role supporting charities and creating a better world. Mr Swanston, who is Deputy Principal at St Vincent's, said he was proud to be shortlisted amongst many inspiring teachers, but that the recognition for the school, including students, staff and the wider community, was also important. The winner of the award wins $1 million, which is around £750,000. 10 finalists will be chosen in October, with the winner announced in November. Conservative MPs have called for careers advice to be offered to all pupils from Year 7 to Year 13 in schools in England. MP for Workington, Mark Jenkinson, says this is needed if the government is serious about levelling up, according to a report in the Evening Standard. Introducing his Education Careers Guidance in Schools Bill, Mr Jenkinson said it would simplify the current law and create a level playing field across academies and state-funded schools. The bill will go to a second reading after being unopposed. Mr Jenkinson spoke about the stark disadvantages faced by many young people, and that careers advice is one of the most important weapons against disadvantage. At present, the statutory duty to provide careers guidance applies to maintained schools, special schools and pupil referral units, but not academies, although many academies do have contractual obligations to provide careers advice via their funding agreements. Labour's Shadow Education Minister Peter Kyle said the bill was a vital way to expose children to alternative options to work with those surrounding them when growing up. Ofsted Chief Inspectors and the Prisons Inspectorate have written a joint commentary discussing the impact of COVID-19 on prison education and have announced the launch of a new prison education review. According to details published on the Ofsted website, the findings highlight the significant impact the pandemic has had on prison education, although it also acknowledges that the quality of provision was already poor. A series of recommendations includes advice to prison leaders to ensure assessments are used effectively, vocational training opportunities are provided, and learners should be back in the classroom as quickly as possible. This has been your weekend news.
Right, okay, welcome back. Apologies for the sound there. We've been told that the volume is quite low. It is a technical issue. We will try to get that fixed for you next week. So if you didn't hear the news, we do apologise for that. Okay, moving on. Annabelle is the founding director of Balance for Teachers, where she helps teachers ditch the overwhelm and find a work-life balance through self-confidence coaching. As a teenager, she inherited an eating disorder after experiencing complex grief that led to high levels of anxiety, until eventually at 21, she was hospitalized with dissociative disorders. Her personal journey of recovery formed the balance method and the pillars of health and confidence that since has helped thousands of people ditch the overwhelm and have more self-confidence. Annabelle, how are you?
Good morning, Sabia. I'm very well, thank you.
Brilliant. Annabelle, I've just gone through your history and background. Can you tell us, when you were going through these things as a child, did you have any support?
It's such an interesting question, because perspective changes over the years. So when I was younger, I wasn't even aware that I wasn't getting support. I was getting support, but in the way that was very literal. So I had a very loving family. My dad was a teacher. He was very caring, very aware, and they helped in any way they could. But mental well-being wasn't a thing when I was a kid. So I'm really enthusiastic when I go on Instagram now and I go on to all the different social medias, and so many teachers are talking about how do I support the well-being of the children as they come back from the pandemic and those that have experienced grief. Because I'm kind of the future version of those children that potentially don't get to actually process what they've been through. And my coping strategies ended up with that severe coping, maladaptive coping strategy of disassociating. So I ended up with seizures at stage 5 burnout, because my way of trying to control from that experience of going through grief was to control everything, was to work more, was to try and do more every single day, to try and control not only my work, but also the food I was eating. It wasn't a case of I wanted to be skinny when I was a teenager. It's now recognized that children with eating disorders as teenagers, grief is one of the reasons, because they don't know how to understand or control the experience of going through death, and they end up trying to control different things. So as a child, yes, I was cared for. I was an academic. I got good grades. I was doing everything that a child that's okay looks okay. But when you look at what we know now in terms of mental health and well-being, I was burning myself out from the age of 12 when I went through that process of grief, all the way to the point that I was 21 when I was hospitalized, because my anxiety was so high that even a bright light or a loud sound would cause my body to just faint and pass out and just have a seizure, because I'd been under chronic stress for all of those years. So what I've put my body through ended up with that point where I was studied to see if it was anything physiological that was occurring. And when the doctors turned around to me and said, there's literally nothing we can do for you. And this happens to a lot of teachers. They get to the burnout stage, they go to their GP. And I've got clients that have gone with migraines, daily migraines. I've had clients that have gone and they've just been diagnosed with burnout, and they've been told to rest for 3 weeks, a month. And it's really difficult, because when you're in that moment, you're someone that wants to have control, yet your body is saying, no, I can't do this anymore. So it was, yes, the support was there, but what had happened was I'd become more of a victim. So I'd actually, because I was getting support on the literal way of saying support, so like seeing doctors and people coming to me trying to save me, I wasn't saving myself. So I'd learned coping strategies in terms of getting other people to fix me. And when the doctors turned around and said, I'm sorry, there's literally nothing we can do, you have to work on anxiety and reducing anxiety in your body and the threats that you perceive in the world, you know, they didn't even go into that much detail. I just walked out of that hospital unit thinking, I've got to find a way to help myself. I have to fix this. I've done this to myself. And I was angry as well, because I was like, I'm not faking it. It's not something I could control. It's just happening. And that started my journey, Sabia. So I then spent the next 10 years recovering from burnout and studying. And the more I learned about anxiety and stress, the more I wanted to study more. And that's where my journey went.
And that's really, thank you for sharing that, because obviously it's quite personal. If you could go back then and change something, what would you change or do differently had you known some of this stuff?
See, I've had this question in the past before, and I find it difficult because nowadays I look back and think I wouldn't be who I am today with Balance for Teachers and preventing stress-related illness within the education sector if I hadn't gone through it, because I haven't just book learnt, if that makes sense. So like everything that I teach and coach in, I've done myself over those 10 years in order to feel human again and actually feel like myself again and feel energetic every single day and be able to handle anything that gets thrown at me. And if I hadn't been through that, would I have been able to cope with what I can cope with now? Probably not, because I wouldn't have that skill set. However, if in another reality something else happened, I think we'll go back to that moment where as a child, a 12-year-old child, I sat there and I've been through coaching and therapy with this, and I still remember, and it's quite strong for me, is I sat by my bed when I was informed that my nan had passed away, and my perception of the event was that I was alone. I wasn't. Years later, I had a conversation and spoke to other people, and actually I wasn't alone. So I think if I could have changed anything, I would have asked for help in that moment or followed those people that had left the room because they were upset, and just asked for a hug. So when I look back in, whenever I feel anxious nowadays, I find a way to either give myself a hug or reach out to someone for a hug. And that was one of the ways that helped me to recover from burnout.
And obviously we know why you've started the work that you do. Can you just explain to us what are healthy boundaries? Because obviously you go into this section on your website where you talk about how to implement boundaries to prevent burnout. Because part of this, that's part of this process of actually being self-aware and knowing yourself. So can you just explain that? What are healthy boundaries and why are those boundaries good for us as teachers?
Indeed. So healthy boundaries, and this is, I go into a lot about the power of language and the way that we speak, because we often, and I hear teachers do this a lot, say, you know, I've got to set my boundaries, I need to stick to my boundaries. But what actually are they? Because healthy boundaries are the ones that work for you. You are on your own journey. You are experiencing your school, your class, your life. It's for you, naturally for you. So what I mean by this is, in order to create healthy boundaries, we have to learn to put ourselves first. And that's one of the biggest hurdles that often teachers have, because they're in the caring industry, which is why work-related burnout is so high. It's in hospitals, like nurses, teachers, doctors. They're all the ones that really struggle with burnout because they're in the caring sector. So they care about other people, but often they are doing or behaving in a way that's trying to save others and forgetting about themselves. So we can't save anyone. We can't do that. People have to do that for themselves. I had to learn to do that to recover from burnout. It's about working out your own healthy boundaries. In other words, making agreements in any given moment. And we cover this within the balance strategy, because your life is a journey. And it's going to keep going, and you're going to have different scenarios and situations. As a coach, I cannot hold your hand every single day. I can't be by your side if you are feeling anxious. Same as a teacher, you cannot be with your students all the time, every single day. They need to be able to have the skills and the coping strategies to go into the world and be able to deal with any situational scenario that they come across. So it's about creating boundaries that work for you. So when I do a 5-day free challenge to discover life outside work, what we're focusing on is saying, you, in the position you are in right now, your unique life, what are the things you dislike? What are the things that you just go, I really don't want that in my life anymore. I feel like I've passed that habit or chapter. And then you get to flip it to find out what you actually do want and start to create boundaries to help you to get there. Because the boundaries you create will all be around your purpose. When I create boundaries, it's about reducing stress-related illness, not just for others, but for myself too. So if I create a boundary, I need to know that it aligns with my purpose, that actually I'm living what I preach. And I'm creating a boundary that's going to assist me to prevent stress-related illness. And that all revolves around those core values as well. So it really depends on you as an individual. What's your purpose? If you know your purpose, you'll know how to create your boundaries. But a good place to start is just to say to yourself, okay, what don't I like right now? What is not helping me reach my intention and goal? And how do I flip it into what I do want?
And so as teachers, everybody knows that we are in that caring industry. It's hard to say no without offending people and without looking bad in front of senior leaders. What language should we be using, and how should we set boundaries to let the other person know that this isn't going to happen anymore, or, you know, this is how it's going to work from now on?
Indeed. So I hear this often. Many teachers say, you know, it's very difficult to say no. The first thing I want to say, and for some people, this may be a friction point. For others, they'll feel, okay, it makes sense in that perspective. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But for me, firstly, you can never offend anyone. You just can't do it. You don't have the power to do it. You don't have the control to do it. To be offended is a choice. So the other person is reacting to what they perceive to be the consequence of the boundary that you've created on them. So in other words, what we're saying is, if you've created a boundary and someone else perceives that boundary as a threat, or they've had an experience in their life at some point where they think that your meaning of that boundary is going to cause them a potential threat, then they're going to react to it. Okay, so there's nothing we can do to control that. Depending on their experience, you don't know someone's life. You don't know if they've had someone else have a boundary like that. They may be someone who doesn't particularly like change. Al was covering this brilliantly earlier when he was talking all about like simple steps and really talking to people as you make changes. And Sabir, yourself, you were saying about how you are working with people within the schools, either one-to-one or as groups, to give them information to help them to grow. So when you're setting a boundary, you always get to not just make an agreement internally, but also externally as well. You have decided on a self-growth path that is going to help you. Now, that means that it may or may not help the people around you. But if you're a teacher and you love the school you work in, but you feel or you perceive that if you were to ask for a little bit of extra time to do your reports, that might cause an issue and other things are going to happen. Now, I've had this situation and a teacher messaged me and said, oh my gosh, I've been to the doctor, the GP signed me off. And instead of working all night, I just followed your advice. And I went to my line manager and I asked for an extension and they gave me 2 extra days, which means I got sleep and I felt a lot better and a lot more focused. I've had another teacher that I've coached who, she for a long time was with her NQTs doing the marking for the NQT and then showing what she'd done so that she could educate the new NQT. Now, that was all well and good, but she was already inundated and she was struggling with all of it. And she was like, I can't really ask. Like, I can't really tell them that I don't want to do this because technically it's sort of part of my job. So she went to a line manager and explained what her agreement was and her boundary and said, I'm willing to mark 5 of them. And then I want her to do the rest, but she can use those 5 as a guideline. I'm not going to do as many to keep up that speed. And he went, great, no problem. And she was ecstatic. She said, you know what? He wasn't even bothered. He just wanted to know exactly what I was doing so he could get on with what he was doing. And I had in my head overthought all of this. So when we're setting boundaries, I kind of put it as 3 steps. Be specific with your boundary is step 1. We often go, you know, I'm going to finish work early. Well, what does that even mean? What time are you finishing? Like, how are you going to communicate that you're finishing early to someone? Because early to one person is early to different to someone else. Step 2 is to listen to the feedback from those around you. So whenever we set a new boundary, it's change for someone else as well. And the first thing you have to do is stick to your own boundary. Because if you're telling people that you're not going to stay late and then you're staying late, you're confusing people. They don't really know what your boundary is. You are teaching them that they subconsciously teaching them that you will stay late. And then they will just follow that pathway. So we have taught people our old boundaries and they have to unlearn those old boundaries and habits the same way we do. So it's about having compassion for them and really listening. So when you set a boundary, speak your boundary. When I started to say to people, I'm going to go to bed at 10:30, it's really funny because nowadays people just know. Like someone messaged a family group and the next day my mum said to me, she went, I don't know why they messaged that time. We all know you're in bed by 10:30, right? Everyone just knows it now. They don't even question it. I've had friends say to me, why, what are you doing up? When I was first learning that boundary, what are you doing up? It's 10:30. Shouldn't you be asleep? Because I'd communicated clearly that I would be in bed at 10:30. And then I did it so regularly that when I did slip up, people went, well, this is weird. And it's the same for the other way around. And step three is finding the solution. So if people have, you know, oh, a question. So for example, you let someone know your boundary. Maybe, you know, I've had people that have said, I want to sort out my eating at dinner. Well, you've got a whole family to consider. So you might say, okay, well, how can we make an agreement that suits all of us when we sit down at the dinner table? So it helps me to move forward, but it allows me to communicate. So step one, be specific. Step two, listen to the feedback and repeat it back to them. And find step three, find that agreement with them in order to move forward together towards your goal.
That was brilliantly explained. Thank you so much. In terms of the balance strategy that you've established, can you go into a bit more detail about that? Is this part of it?
Yeah, so the balance strategy is everything that I did over 10 years that you can implement in 30 seconds. And that seems like, what? Like, what do you mean I could just do it like really, really quickly? The balance strategy is a combination of everything that I've experienced in terms of recovering from burnout and reducing anxiety and stress, but it's also all of the qualifications I've done in advanced stress management, nutrition, physical fitness, motivational mindset. It's putting it all together because there were patterns that I kept seeing. And I thought, how do I every single day, even when there's moments of stress or anxiety, manage to have post-traumatic growth? We don't often talk about this, but we talk about PTSD in extreme situations that have happened, but we don't talk about post-traumatic growth, which is also possible. So the balance strategy was me looking back and saying, well, how did I grow every day, even when I was in a narcissistic relationship, when I was going through the eating disorder, when I had a dissociation? You know, I've been seizure-free for over 5 years now, and it doesn't even cross my mind. So what I did was I laid back, I think it was the first lockdown. It was Christmas Day, probably the second lockdown by that point. I lost track of time like everyone else. So I laid back on Christmas Day and I refused to leave my bed until I'd put everything that I'd done in 10 years into a strategy that people could utilize. Because if I was going to try and reduce stress-related illness throughout the education sector, it had to be simple and easy to apply because teachers don't have a lot of time. And I didn't have a lot of time. I was working 16-hour days, 7 days a week right at the beginning. I was pushing myself beyond like ridiculous. What I managed to get my body to do was incredible. But I thought, well, how do I do this in just a short space of time? And I know teachers love an acronym. So I thought I would put it into an acronym, and balance was what came out of it. So the first step is to breathe. When you breathe out, the longer you breathe out, the more you trigger your vagus nerve. And the more you do that, it triggers your parasympathetic nervous system, which is your rest and digest mode. Now, if you are in your reaction mode, so if you imagine someone that's anxious, they tend to have short breaths, increases your carbon dioxide level in your blood. And what that does is it means you're in that fight or flight, you're in your limbic system of your brain. You are not going to be able to focus. You are not going to be able to make good decisions. And I was doing this a lot at the beginning. My decisions were poor decisions, and it's all I could work with. I was constantly in that stress mode. So if you allow yourself to breathe and take a longer out breath first, you can then line your next step to listen to self, which is the A and the L. Then you can make an agreement of the next step to cheer you and evolve. So that is the balance strategy, and it gets put into all of the different strategies that I do. But in any moment that you feel stressed, it's helping you to switch off your HPA system, which is your stress response system of your body, so that you can come into your more thinking part of your brain, to be able to make a focused decision on whatever your chosen next step is. So it's not about me as a coach going, oh, you should do this to reduce stress, you should do that. No, it's about you saying, what could I do to make a boundary or agreement that helps me to move forward to better serve my own purpose and goal?
That's brilliant. We've just had some comments come in saying that this is all really useful stuff you're giving, which is fantastic, because obviously, presumably, a lot of educators and people who are not educators who listen into the show will be looking at some of those strategies they can use in their daily habits. Speaking of habits, Annabelle, one of the problems that I have is that I struggle to form new habits. How do I deal with that? So, for example, if your reaction is, if you're the kind of person who does react quickly and you're not good at habits as well, how do you overcome that, and how do you develop those habits?
So the first thing I would say is there's no such thing as a good or bad habit. Okay, we say there is. We also talk about breaking habits. You can't break a habit, in my opinion, right? What we do is we transfer to something else. So we already have habits. So I would say to you, Sabia, is it 100% true that you can't, or you struggle to create new habits?
I would say that I've got a very short attention span, that I will do something for some time and then I would lose concentration, for example. So for example, I will build up a habit for maybe a week, and then a week later, I'm probably out of habit again. So it's something like that.
Get that. So do you manage to get yourself to work on time?
Yes, I do.
Cool. Do you manage to go to an assembly if it gets called?
Yes, I do.
Awesome. Did you start anything new last week, which you've never done before, but you just started to do every single day?
I did actually. I started a new planner where I'm documenting everything that I'm doing.
Amazing. So we often, again, it comes back to language. So the question that you asked there was, you know, I struggle to form new habits. Well, that's not 100% true. But our ego only sees sort of black and white, 100% or zero. Like it can't differentiate. But actually, you can create habits. They just may not be the ones you are trying to move forward with right now. So you might have to break them down a little bit smaller, a bit like Al was saying about technology. Some people have already got experience of certain things, so they can jump straight into it. Whereas other things are a little bit trickier. You've probably, I would imagine, Sabia, written journals and things like that before.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So that's quite an easy habit for part of you to get back into, because you've already learned and experienced writing before, or writing in a form of journal. And there's lots of stuff on social media that presents journals as a really good thing to do. And so you've got that impact, authority, and repetition, which allows you to grow. Now, the challenging thing is when you're trying to create a new habit, but you have no prior experience. So imagine your classroom comes into you, and those children have no experience of what you're about to teach today. Sabia, would you expect them to just get it?
No, of course not.
So why would you expect yourself to?
Okay.
So what we do as humans is we go through four stages to create a habit. And this is part of the balance strategy as well. You're first of all, initially unconsciously incompetent, which means you don't even know you can't do it. Right. So what that means is, and this stage can go on for quite a long time, is say, for example, someone wanted to go on to a weight loss program. They're probably not even thinking about it at first. They're probably still eating the way they're eating. They're unconsciously unaware that they're not eating properly. Then the next stage is they become consciously incompetent. And I use weight loss because a lot of people have kind of experienced this, but it works for anything. You are learning any new habits in any form. So you've gone from unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. In other words, you know you're struggling to do it, right? Which is when some people sort of go, oh, you know, I'm going to start a diet. Like, don't really know what they're going to do. They have no real plan or what they're going to actually tweak or anything like that. Then they become consciously competent. They either ask for help, or they start to learn, or they make mistakes. You were talking about failure earlier. The faster you fail, the more you learn. And you become consciously competent, but you're still trying to actually get that information in. And then eventually over time, you become unconsciously competent. So we have to go through all four stages to create a new habit. Now, what you were saying earlier, Sabia, was, you know, I drop off and then I start again, then I drop off and then I start again. Now, if you look back, only an assumption of one time that that happened with a new habit, every time you fell off and then jumped back on again, did you find that the spaces between were a little bit shorter each time?
Yeah, obviously, the more you do something, the more familiar you become with it.
Indeed. So what happens is a lot of people go, oh, you know, I just fail every time. Well, that's not true. When you've got a habit, you have an old habit which served a reason. Now, I'm speaking very literal, but when we go on our coaching calls, when we do the 5-day challenge, we go a little bit deeper and we talk about what things mean to parts of us. And actually, for me, like one interesting thing is I used to emotionally eat with chocolate. And I went through, because that's a coping strategy. And I actually did it yesterday and I spotted it. Was it yesterday or the day before? I spotted it yesterday or the day before. I was sat there and suddenly I craved chocolate. And because I know what chocolate means to me, I know what the real reason was. So I was sat there and eating chocolate was a kind of, I would have said, was a bad habit of a coping strategy. But it actually served me in the moment, because when I studied what chocolate meant to me, I looked at the food, sat back and went, okay, it's straight, it's square. You know how chocolate looks. It's like nice and organized squares. And, you know, it feels like calming and soft. And then I get that kick out of it afterwards. When I actually looked into it, what chocolate meant to me was organization. It meant organization and feeling good after having things organized. In that moment I craved chocolate, I was sat there with this big project, which felt really messy. And I had loads of things that had just started to creep onto my to-do list. So I stopped for a moment. I then organized everything into what actually needed to be done that day and what could wait. And suddenly the craving went. I didn't need the chocolate anymore, because what I actually wanted was to be organized. So a habit before was still serving me, but it was serving me to feel organized and get that kick, like happy feeling, when actually eating chocolate all the time was not going to fix the actual problem, because all I was going to do was just feel sick after eating too much chocolate and I'd still be disorganized and it would go on for months. So in order to create a new habit, we get to appreciate that the old habit was serving us. And this is when I talk about making tweaks of the week. So when I changed my diet to heal my stomach and to actually clear up the IBS caused from stress, I went through a stage of just every week I'd go to the shop and I'd just tweak one thing. So I knew that refined sugar wasn't helping me. So I would go, right, okay, read a label of yogurt that's got less sugar in it, swap it. And then I'd swap the next thing. So you can do this in any area of your life, but it's a process where you need compassion. I call this a self-care triangle. Compassion, patience, and consistency will create any new habit.
Brilliant. You've explained that in so much detail. Thank you so much. Annabelle, just to finish us off, can you give some details out where people can find you, please?
Yes, of course. So Balance for Teachers is on Facebook. If you type in Balance for Teachers on Facebook, you'll be able to see it on there. I'm at Teachers Work Life Balance Coach on Instagram. So that's Teachers Work Life Balance Coach on Instagram. Or you can visit the website, which is www.worklifebalanceforteachers.com. And that will have all the information on there as well.
Great. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you today, Annabelle.
My pleasure, Sobia.
Thank you for coming onto the show. Right. Okay. We've run over time slightly. That's it for today. It's been an absolute blast. Graham's up next. He will be talking about crap technology in schools. Then it's Khalil and then it's Hareen to finish off with some socializing this evening. Thank you so much for listening and I will see you next week.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.